Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Michael Tunnell joins me. We're going to be talking about GNOME, the desktop you're probably already using. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Michael Tunnell. Episode 548, recorded September 25th, 2019. GNOME. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, the original podcast from Red Hat. It's back for its third season, and this time it's all about the epic history of programming languages. Episode 7 covers the origins of AI and its very first language, Lisp. Go to redhat.com/heroes or listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab with more than $500 million of equipment. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day, and I bet this is one of them, projects you may want to download right after this show and play with, and this may also be one of those. Joining me once again, although after a brief absence, Michael Tunnell. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back, especially on this topic. I'm very interested in it.
And you jumped forward immediately as soon as we announced that this was going to be one of the shows, which I really appreciate. But before we get into that, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm from Alabama, and I have a hopefully solid connection. I had some issues earlier today, so hope this is going to stay good.
Well, I'll wave in your general direction. I'm still in my home in Beaverton, Oregon. I'll be here through next week, and then the following week I'll be in where am I back? Oh, I'm back to Tijuana in 2 weeks, so that'll be fun.
Nice.
The Tijuana Tequila Festival happens every year, and I'm going down, of course, as I make my annual trek to go there. It's a really incredibly crazy experience. I'll talk more about it in 2 weeks when I'm actually there. Anyway, so today we have an interesting show. It's GNOME, and I hope it's pronounced with a hard G. I actually don't know, but I presume it's like the GNU project where the G is hard. And GNOME is a very well-established desktop. And what that means is it's the software you're interacting with as you're sitting at your computer or your laptop or whatever. I guess those are both computers. And you have, you know, windows you move around. You have a mouse that does things. You have arbitrary settings on things. You customize it for the way you want to work, and it basically enables you to use your computer in a useful way. Every computer that has a graphic interface has some sort of thing like GNOME, but GNOME is one of the most mature and the most popular. Would that be fair to say, Michael?
I would say it's definitely one of the most popular. It's actually the default desktop for a lot of distributions, including Ubuntu and Fedora. So it is one of the most popular ones for sure. There's actually quite a few that are equally as well-polished and stuff like that. But there's so many desktop environments in the Linux world that it's kind of funny just how many there are. There's a release about 12 to 15 or so. But GNOME is right at the top. It's definitely the most popular for sure.
So is it GNOME or GNOME?
Well, it's technically GNOME, but I interchange them because habit. But it is GNOME. I sometimes okay. just right. to make sure I get it right, I say GNOME GNOME.
Okay. So. Well, that'll work. That'll definitely work. So today we have an interesting guy on. I'm hoping he's an interesting guy. I presume he is. Neil McGovern. He's the executive director of the GNOME Foundation and is responsible for the day-to-day running of the organization. So he's been around for a while, and he's going to be talking to us today about the place of GNOME in history and future. And I hope we don't give him too much pressure there to deal with all that. Anything more before I read the ad and bring him on?
No, I think it's quite interesting. I want to get to it at some point that he's also has a pilot's license and a snowboarder. So I would say he's definitely on the interesting part.
Oh man, pilot's license. Well, I can certainly talk to him about that. I'm 270 hours in the left seat, so that will definitely be fun. But before we bring him on, I do have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, the original podcast from Red Hat. Lisp was created in the 1950s to teach machines how to learn, but it would take more than 40 years before people started to see the full promise of AI. Command Line Heroes is back for its third season, and it's all about programming languages. From C to JavaScript to Ruby to Lisp, the podcast dives into the origin stories of some of the most prominent languages around. Episode 7 covers the history of AI, starting with its first language, Lisp. It was created to teach machines how to learn like humans. And at the start, there was a wave of interest and investment. But ultimately, the timing and hardware wasn't quite right for AI to work. Decades later, AI is now on the verge of changing everything. Command Line Heroes, an original podcast from Red Hat, is all about the people who transform tech from the command line up. To listen and subscribe, head over to the podcast platform of your choice or visit redhat.com/heroes. That's redhat.com/HEROES. That's where you find full episodes as well as bonus content. And you can even test your skills on the Command Line Bash arcade game. That's redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Red Hat for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring Neil McGovern on. Neil, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
So I'm in Cambridge in the UK.
Now that's Cambridge in the UK, not Cambridge School in the US.
That's right, yeah. So, just about 60 miles north of London or so.
Okay. So talk to us about GNOME in general. So what problem is it solving? Did I characterize it fairly accurately?
Yeah, sure. So the GNOME project is there to provide a fully free software, open source desktop environment that's elegant and simple to use and kind of exists just to get out your way and allow people to get on with work that they want to do. And to do that in a way that's privacy respecting and make sure that people can really use free software on their day-to-day computing.
Now, would you say it's fair to characterize something like GNOME or any desktop like that to be the equivalent of, say, macOS for people running Apples and the Windows interface for Windows?
Yeah, sure. There's a couple of levels. So obviously you have the kernel, which is Linux, which is running underneath. But GNOME really tries to be a whole desktop environment. So not just you can move Windows about, but a lot of the plumbing and the work you get underneath it as well to make sure people have a really good experience using it. So when I describe it to friends and family, so my parents, I kind of say it's kind of like a replacement for macOS or Windows. Yeah.
So it's also probably a service discovery system, because let's say an application wants to send mail. Well, it needs to know how to talk to the default mailer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have, as part of making this sort of smooth, integrated experience, we have things like integration through something called GNOME Online Accounts with things like Gmail or Exchange Systems or Office or even people's individual mail servers as well. So you can kind of configure those in one place, and then all your applications can then use that information to kind of get the information they need.
And is this designed to be used only by computer experts, or is this the kind of thing that your mom can use?
No, absolutely.
I'm not saying anything bad about your mom.
certainly my parents are not the most technical in the world, but yeah, it's okay. Definitely designed to be able to be used by everyone. Like we follow a school of thought where things should just work out of the box, and we should have like really good defaults, and everything should just kind of work and be really usable for everyone.
And what's the most difficult part of doing that? I mean, making things easy to use is always a goal, but it doesn't always get achieved. So what have you been particularly focused on to really make that work for the general public?
So one of the really key things about GNOME and the way we do things is GNOME is designed. And when I say designed, I don't just mean sort of made to look pretty, although it being attractive is obviously part of that. One of the really important things for us is that it has actual user testing and user feedback. So we spend quite a lot of time actually going and testing our concepts and seeing how people use computers in the real world. And that can be for the stuff we already have, but it can be our ideas and our designs get user feedback as well. So we recently redesigned, a good example of this is that we recently redesigned our settings panel, so where you can pick your Wi-Fi network. And before a single line of code was written for that, we got a load of wireframes and got people to point at different bits of where they'd expect to be able to set their background and things like that.
Cool.
So we put a lot of effort into making sure that that works really well and that there's very sort of scientific engineering approach to how that works and making sure that sort of comes into the desktop as a whole.
Now, I presume a lot of this is being able to be done by volunteers, but are you also taking foundation money and paying professionals for some of this?
Yeah, so at the foundation, about 18 months ago, we went through a period of expansion. So we now have 7 full-time members of staff, including myself, who work for the foundation. That's really quite an exciting thing to be able to go from about 2 years ago, where there was a couple of us, to actually a number of people who are working and helping directly with GNOME Project and working on the code itself as well.
And does most of the funding from the foundation come from the people who give it out to disk wheel, like Red Hat and stuff?
It's really broad. So we have obviously advisory boards where we have people like Red Hat, like SUSE, like Debian, like Canonical are on it as well. But we do rely a lot on actual public donations. So the majority of our money that we get as a foundation and a project comes from donations. We've never really been corporate sponsored, with a sort of big broad church where everyone who's interested can kind of get involved. So it's a community based project.
Okay, well that's nice. So that you've really got a collective work being done by collective people and being able to contribute to multiple outlets, which is really sort of the whole crux of open source. So that's really nice. I've totally lost my train of thought. Michael, you want to take it for a second?
Absolutely. So you're the executive director of the GNOME Foundation, and has to tell a lot of things. So what are like your biggest challenges and focal points about being the director of the foundation?
So the kind of biggest thing I try and do is, apart from the day-to-day things that we're doing, is which is things like boring things like but important things like making sure our tax returns are done or we have a budget for the next year.
The best.
And yeah, absolutely. Lots of talking to lawyers, which is fun. But there's some exciting things like helping organize our yearly conferences or kind of trying to bring a strategy of how we can kind of push free software desktops in general forward and kind of make sure we continue on that path. So we're kind of aiming to sort of widen the appeal of free software, especially on the desktop in general as well. So it's kind of working on how we can do that and kind of driving that forward.
Nice. Speaking of conferences, there's the Linux App Summit is coming up in November, and I was wondering what is like the end goal for that conference, and like what is the plans for like. And I also really like the fact that you are doing it alongside the E project to collectively make this. So like, what is the end goal for that conference?
So what we really want there is increased visibility and focus on applications on the desktop. Interesting, we also, GNOME itself did it last year in the form of Libre Application Summit, which we had a load of people from KDE come to as well. One of the things that we're really trying to sort of work on is to sort of foster a vibrant Linux desktop application ecosystem. So we're super happy to work with anyone who kind of wants to also increase that. We think that availability of software that is free and means people don't have to rely on proprietary desktops and proprietary systems is important. So it's one of the reasons, for example, that we're kind of sponsoring and running Flatpak and FlatHub. So things that really make developing for the Linux desktop more accessible and a better place for application authors to kind of come along and develop for it.
Nice. So speaking of like on the same lines of the kind of like the things that you're doing, what is the relationship between the GNOME Foundation and Flatpaks? I know you're saying you're sponsoring it, but how integrated is that that connection?
So Flatpak and FlatHub are, the GNOME Foundation is, for example, we're paying for all the hosting. We're paying for legal work and sysadmin work to kind of deal with that. I think both Flatpak and FlatHub are things that have come out of GNOME, but for those people who sort of work alongside GNOME and the stuff we do, we try and make a lot of our stuff not specific to the GNOME desktop. So certainly with Flatpak and FlatHub, we have a lot of interest from KDE and other people about being able to use that. So it's certainly something that's kind of hosted on our infrastructure. We're paying for it, and we're super happy to keep on doing that because we think it's a important tool for being able to kind of produce apps and a important way of distributing things, certainly in the future.
Very nice. I'm very interested in Flatpaks. I do like the work that you are doing there, and I realize that it's not like it's not like trying to be like a complete changer of the frameworks, but I do like the fact that it's focused on the desktop, like the GNOME Foundation does with the GNOME desktop itself. And I also was like, the GNOME Foundation is launching some new stuff with like the Coding Education Challenge. So when I looked into this, I couldn't really find a lot of information on this part. So I was wondering, like, what's the time frame of the challenge going to be?
Yeah, sure. So we've only recently announced this. So for those who haven't heard of this, I think it's fair to say that over a number of years that software education hasn't been the best, certainly in the UK, and I think throughout the world it's not been great. There's levels where you can get, so you have things like Scratch where you have block-based programming, and then you have Python, and so there's nothing really in between. And so the aim of this is to really try and get ideas and sort of crowdsource ideas from everyone in the world about how to teach people how to code and how to code free software, particularly, and kind of really encouraging the sort of next generation of people to come and sort of take on the work that we've been doing. And there's going to be a number of rounds of this. So we're hoping to announce in January the first sort of opening of rounds. And we're after a number of ideas from anyone in the world on how to improve getting people to code free software. And after that, I think the top 20 ideas received $6,500 each. To kind of generate into the next stage, which is a prototype. And so and the next 3 months later, we pick the top five ideas, which receive $25,000 each, and then into a sort of final stage where the sort of top prize is $100,000 to kind of make something and kind of roll out a scheme.
Very nice. So let's move on to a little bit of like a kind of a fun question. So in the chat room, Gray580 is asking, does the GNOME Foundation have a foot for the logo? What's the story behind that?
I think originally someone so this was over 20 years ago now when this first kind of came up. It's actually I think a stylized G. So it's meant to be kind of like a G, and then someone I think decided it looked a bit like a foot, and then it kind of just stuck from there. So it's kind of a historical thing, but it's a stylized G that looks like a foot. I should probably talk to some marketing and branding people to try and have some nice words around, oh, it actually means going forward and stepping forward or something, but it pretty much is, originally looks like a G.
Yeah. So I like that. It's more like just it is what it is. So just but yeah, if you can get it, I like the idea of like retroactively giving it a meaning, like the stepping forward thing. That'd be funny. I think that GNOME is one of those interesting desktops as well. And how does it work with all the different distributions that are like using GNOME as a default or GNOME as the default? And how does the work that they're doing on their distribution or distro side, and like how does that stuff go upstream, and how do you do like kind of to differentiate between what one distro is doing and what you want to take from the other and that kind of thing?
So I think we've seen quite a lot of distribution sort of coming back to GNOME, certainly since Ubuntu's announcement that they dropped Unity and are moving back to GNOME has been really interesting, and I think a really good thing for free software in general. And certainly for GNOME. As I mentioned before, we have an advisory board, so lots of the distributions sit on that, and we meet a couple of times a year in person to kind of run through challenges they're having and sort of the direction GNOME is going, to really kind of see where it fits in and how people are doing things. And we've seen, and that's been really useful because it's at the moment it's entirely through distributions that GNOME gets into the hand of end users. So the user feedback we get from that is really, really valuable. And we've seen some other things recently to do with trying to work out vendor theming, for example. So each distribution obviously wants their own look and style, as to kind of be distinct and kind of have their own experience. And so we've been helping work out how that fits into the upstream project and how we can support that as well.
So nice. I think that's really interesting. And I do like the idea of like all the different distributions working together and having upstream stuff, because that's really one of the most, that's like one of the fundamental things of open source and just the community in general. And one of the things that, you know, of course, we're going to have to ask you, do you think that the year of the Linux desktop is ever going to happen? Because that's just a requirement, apparently. So.
So I think every time someone says that phrase, it possibly slips a year for the rack. But I mean, in some ways, it depends what you mean by desktop and the year of the Linux desktop and what you mean. If you look at the K-12 in the US, then it's already happened. It happened 5 years ago. The biggest desktop system in use is Chromebooks. Certainly at universities, then a huge part is using Raspberry Pis, for example. So there's this big concept of what is the year of Linux desktop and when is it going to be? All I think we need to kind of carry on doing is keep on pushing forward, keep on making sure that we push free software and keep the importance of free software and open computing and the importance that gives to users as well, and the user freedom at kind of at the forefront, and just keep moving forward and keep on doing what we're doing, and then fingers crossed we'll carry on getting there.
So I'm a little curious because you say that GNOME runs on all these other distributions. It can't be that all those distributions have identical interfaces. So is there some sort of adapter slick that has to go in, and who's providing that? Is that being provided by the like Red Hat and Debian, or is that being provided by GNOME as the Red Hat adapter?
So normally it depends on which distribution it is. So people like Fedora and Red Hat and Debian, they run pretty much a vanilla version of GNOME. other people want to adapt it and adjust things as they do. There's a number of extensions that people can use to kind of modify the way GNOME looks and then the way it works slightly. And then there's some theming people do to try and change the default colors as well. Now, those themes are normally provided either directly by those distributions. Ubuntu maintain the Yaru theme, which is the, kind of their look and feel, and a couple of extensions, which are either come directly from the distributions or from just generally in the community. So it's something that we support, is the ability to kind of use extensions to tweak the way GNOME works for kind of particular use cases and how people want it to particularly work.
Okay, and I presume that if I wanted to write a utility or a tool or something that worked in and fit in within the GNOME, theme, framework, whatever it's called, I presume there are user interface guidelines that people can follow and ensure that their thing sort of looks like part of the system?
Yeah, so one of the things we have, which I think is has really kind of helped sort of pull together everything that from applications to make sure we have this sort of consistent look and feel, we have the human interface guidelines. And this kind of explains how, similar to how you get on Windows or on Mac OS or even iOS or Android, it's a way of sort of describing this is how you should build your app, this is how it should look, this is where to make sure you have consistency with where things go, where they appear. And so we have a fairly extensive human interface guidelines that people can follow to try and to try and make sure you get that consistent look and feel. So when you have an app, it all kind of feels like it all belongs together.
And it also interoperates. Like if it's looking for the mailer, it knows how to find it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do lots of that through various subsystems, which GNOME has developed as well, which are really useful. It's used across many different desktops. So the traditional one is, which I normally say, is you almost every system out there is running GNOME to some level. There's lots of different bits that have come from GNOME that are used to build that desktop. Our own desktop, but they're kind of used all over the place as well.
So I was just going to ask if some of the stuff from GNOME has gone upstream into the various distributions, and I think you just answered that, right?
Yeah, I mean, as a prime example of even stuff that isn't used on the desktop, we have things like Dbus, we have UDiscs, even libxml2 was a GNOME project, so that's used in server environments or kind of all over the place. So there's loads of that sort of plumbing work which GNOME has had to do to kind of get this really good desktop experience, but that is certainly used sort of all over by loads of different people.
Cool. Well, I know Michael's anxious to ask some more questions, but before we do that, we do have an important message, which is: this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, ATC, 10 years ago, and it has grown exponentially. The lab contains more than $500 million in equipment. It's like no other testing and research lab. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation. Hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs represent the newest advances in multi-cloud architecture, security, networking, primary and secondary storage, data analytics, and AI, DevOps, and so much more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox so customers can quickly select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. They offer Lab as a Service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with less investment. The time is finally here. WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. This ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about worldwide technology and join the ATC ecosystem, go to WWT.com/WIT and create an account today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's WWT.com/TWIT. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their sponsorship of FWSC Weekly. Michael, you had some more questions.
So, Neil, you were earlier in the show, you were talking about the user input from the community and the wireframe system and people giving feedback of how that stuff. How can someone get involved in doing that sort of thing and being involved in, you know, giving it their experience through those wireframe focus group sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. So if you have a look at some of the things we do, there's a fair amount. If you just search your favorite search engine for GNOME user testing, then we run normally two or three throughout the year. We also run them at various different conferences. We do something called SpinachCon with Debo Nicholson, which is, and the idea behind that is to try and, her description is, after eating, you just find that little bit of spinach in your teeth and just trying to smooth the edges of things like that. So we run a few things around that each year. The other kind of interesting way is to kind of have a look at our GitLab instance. So gitlab.gnome.org, all the different projects are on there, and people can open issues with the way things work and ideas of how things are designed as well.
Is there a policy where if someone wants to do some kind of interface change that it would be like announced where people can, you know, jump on the GitLab and interact in that way?
Yeah, so I think there's a tag called design as well. So we also have a design team, so a team of UX designers whose job is to kind of come in and make good user interface design as well. So I think whenever there's a new design being thought of, or even if something hasn't been sort of looked at in a while, then there's a list of things that people can come have a look at. Nice. If you have a look at the GNOME desktop YouTube channel, there's a talk from about 3 weeks ago from Alan Day, which was kind of going through the design process and what the design team do. So he gave a talk, and that's on the YouTube channel. So that's probably a really good point to kind of jump in and see how to get involved with that.
Nice. So this is an interesting question, I think, but it's not necessarily one that it's commonly, you know, thought of. But there's a lot of people who have overlap between working with GNOME and working for Red Hat. So I'm curious, like, what is the connection between GNOME and Red Hat?
Red Hat are a member of our advisory board, the same as many other people. So they contribute to it. They also employ a number of people to work directly on GNOME, the same as Canonical do with Ubuntu, same as Endless, SUSE, various other people. So they help sponsor our conferences. They sponsor a couple of servers, but the actual formal relationship, there's not really anything that's kind of formal. Certainly, it's not the case that Red Hat tell us how to do things or direct the project as a whole. We're a US 501c3, which is a wonderfully technical term of basically going non-profit charity. So we literally cannot be controlled by a single entity. And it's in our bylaws that the board of directors can't be controlled by more than 40% of representatives from one organization.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. Because actually, I like Red Hat, but I do like I would rather them be a part of it rather than controlling it. But there has been some, you know, misinformation is spread about Red Hat, like, creating GNOME or having control of it in that sense. So I'm glad to clear that up. I'm curious, what is the approach that GNOME takes when they are, you know, interacting with the community in terms of like making decisions that there's sometimes people would say these are controversial decisions, like removing desktop icons. I personally don't use desktop mm-hmm. icons, but there's been, you know, cases where people were annoyed by that decision being made. What is the policy and interaction that you have with the community in terms of when you make a decision that is not necessarily seen as like beneficial to those people?
So it's normally a fairly straightforward technical decision, as particularly for the use of the desktop icons. That was holding back a lot of the – that was code which was 13, 14 years old and really wasn't being maintained anymore, and it was really holding back the progression of Nautilus, the file manager. So a lot of the stuff that we wanted to do and a lot of the improvements we wanted to make just weren't possible because of this old legacy code, which would break every time we did things. So in order to do that, we have things, we have extensions that people can modify the behavior of the shell to kind of bring back their way of doing things. And in this particular case, that extension that sort of reinstates desktop icons is maintained by the Nautilus maintainer. So the actual guy who sort of took the code out in the first place, he sort of rewrote it and did it as an extension. So if people want to do it like that, again, it's a lot of the decisions we have to make are basically based on technical grounds. So we have a limited number of people who come and contribute to GNOME, like all free software projects. We don't have a magic infinite list of people to maintain everything forever. So we, unfortunately, sometimes we have to make decisions about what we're going to prioritize and where we're going to put work in. And sometimes some code just there isn't anyone to maintain it, or it can be so old that it's just not possible to do anymore.
That makes sense. So as far as some of the codes you make is also the GTK toolkit. And I was curious. I mean, I know it's not actually the GNOME toolkit. So how did that come about where GNOME took over the toolkit?
So I'd say rather than GNOME taking over the toolkit, it is one of the kind of toolkits that we that is important to the foundation and that we certainly support and is obviously used in a lot of places. So in the foundation, we also have things like GIMP is a foundation project and so is things like PTV and as well as GNOME and GTK itself. So we think it's really important and a way of which is a fully free toolkit that works cross-platform and people can use a lot. And in the foundation, for example, we employ Emmanuel Bassi, who's one of the core GTK developers, to work directly on GTK and to try and sort of improve it and push it forward. So again, I think it's one of those examples of the stuff that GNOME does isn't just for GNOME on the desktop. It's trying to really sort of push free software desktops further and kind of make it a more attractive place for the whole ecosystem.
Nice. So speaking of GTK, so there's the development of making GTK 4 is coming some point. Do we have an ETA of when that's planned, or is it still like up in the air with the development stage?
It's still a little bit up in the air. So one of the things we're kind of changing is that we I know that there was a lot of pain when GTK 3 came out. I think that's probably fair to say. But we're one of the things we're trying to do is that when GTK 4 comes out, that will be a stable version. So 4.0 will be the new stable version, and then that can be relied upon rather than things breaking between say 4.0 and 4.1, 4.2. So 4.0 will be the sort of stable version. And so we want to make sure it's actually in a really good place, and it has the ability to sort of release as that stable version before we release it, which is why it sort of seems to be taking a bit longer than previous releases.
Okay. So and some along those lines, when GTK 4 comes out, is there going to be a path that developers can continue with GTK 3 for a little while before they transition? Because one of the things that people were worried about GTK coming or GTK 4 coming was that there's a potential of breaking between 3 and 4, and they wanted to know if there's a way for like an LTS of GTK 3.
Yeah, so GTK 3 will be fully supported. It's not going to get new features, but it's still going to be supported, certainly for the entire lifetime of GTK 4. One thing that is probably worth noting is that the last time I spoke to the sort of GTK developers as a whole, they were kind of indicating that when GTK 4 does come out, then support for GTK 2 is going away, which has been a number of years since that came out. But yeah, so certainly GTK 3 will be fully supported, and hopefully people will start migrating onto the newer toolkits as that happens.
Nice. So the GNOME system is not really dependent on extensions, but how do you think that like I've seen a lot of distributions ship with like some kind of extension built in. Do you think that there is a sweet spot of how many extensions or like what distributions have like certain layouts where they include a lot of extensions? Like, for example, Ubuntu changes it to look kind of Unity like in order to, where they use extensions to do that. Is there any issue where if you hit a certain amount of extensions, that becomes a problem?
Yeah, so the way extensions work at the moment is essentially you're live patching GNOME shell itself. So the more extensions you add, the more possibility of there being instability in there and there being issues with it. I mean, I run a pretty clean system. I think I have one extension installed, which is called Caffeine Plus. Basically, because when LibreOffice goes into presentation mode, sometimes it doesn't sort of inhibit your display going to sleep. So I have a manual switch for that. What can be interesting, and certainly it's less of a problem within the distributions themselves, because what the distributions will do is they will take the shell, add some extensions, and then thoroughly test it themselves to make sure it works. I guess like anything, the more extensions you add to even a browser, then the more likelihood is that they won't interact well, or you end up with a lot of problems like memory issues or kind of issues with the way they kind of interact with each other. So, I mean, generally, I kind of suggest to people that you first try and just run GNOME without extensions as much as you can. And then I'd kind of do a sort of minimal approach to sort of adding things in, just because otherwise you can end up with instability. And we want to kind of make sure that the sort of core is rock solid.
Okay, that makes sense. There's actually something that is asked in the chat room by Keith512. He's asking, well, why is there no menu or launcher editor built into the GNOME desktop? He says, I want to be able to customize my program's launchers and icons. So, like, for example, Menu Libre or a la carte, is there any interest in GNOME shipping with those as a pre-built application part of it, or making their own?
So, I mean, certainly in terms of the sort of the dash system we have, interestingly, in GNOME 3.34, we add the ability to, within the sort of panel where all your applications are, you can add your own folders by sort of dragging and dropping things into there, so that there's an ability to sort of group things yourselves there, and you can add things onto the sort of quick launcher as well quite easily. In terms of sort of having custom themes and sort of modifying yourself, that tends to be something that not a lot of people want to do directly in the UI, and those that do want to do that can be more comfortable using an editor or using either command line or an editor directly. And what people can do is they can edit their desktop files to be able to modify that. To put it within the actual sort of front UI is something that we tend to be very cautious of in the GNOME project. What we want to be able to do is have the is to make it easy to use and have the things that people do most of the time be kind of right up in front and central, and then the sort of more advanced things are really hidden away, sort of that you have to sort of go into more and more depth to be able to get those things. So I don't think it's certainly something we're going to kind of ship by default, given that it's a fairly specialized use case that people can do anyway, but it tends not to be something that we'd kind of put in the front of the user interface.
Okay, I mean that makes sense. As far as it's definitely more of a power user type approach, and they could also just install MenuLibre if they wanted to do that. Another thing I wanted to ask you is about the one of the big elephants in the room for the Linux community is Wayland. And GNOME has decided to be a default toward Wayland, maybe not even just like in most distributions, but just in the sense of like the development focus is heavily on Wayland. How soon do you think Wayland will be ready to go into production more so like on just like the basic distributions?
Debian's last released used Wayland by default. And so if Debian are shipping it by default, that's probably a pretty good indicator of where it's got to. There's still a couple of issues to address with Wayland, but I mean, I've been running it on my laptop for some good about a year and a half now, and it's kind of really improved for me over X. Gang, it's up to individual people how they want to do it. There's a couple of features that would be nice to have in Wayland, but I know they're being worked on. But I mean, hey, with my Debian hat on, I kind of go, if Debian says it's fine for a stable release, then it's probably okay.
Well, we're almost out of time, and so we're going to have to start wrapping this up. But I have had a couple of questions in the chat room, and I don't understand all this stuff because I don't do Linux desktop. But what the heck is KDE, and is this an Emacs versus VI question?
A bit. So KDE is another desktop environment. I think it's kind of designed to be sort of more tweakable and more sort of customizable for power users as well. There is, interestingly, within sort of communities, there's a huge GNOME versus KDE thing, and they get very confused when I tweet happy birthday at KDE and things like that. We actually, within the development teams, we work closely together and we actually talk to each other. But each desktop environment, let's say, has a fan base that kind of think that that's the best and these other ones are terrible. But that happens with all software.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I can still use VI barely, but I'm, my primary editor is Emacs, so. But I can also see that that some of the technologies that are in VI are also in Emacs, and I presume that some of the technologies from KDE have also found their way into GNOME and vice versa. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use VI. Other people use Emacs. Some people use KDE. Some people use GNOME. I mean, the important thing for me is people are using free software on the desktop. I mean, this is awesome. I mean, if it came along tomorrow and that Windows collapsed and XFCE was like the default desktop for everyone in the world, then yay, free software's won. I mean, this is kind of the really important thing for me is that we're empowering user freedoms and that this is where we're kind of getting to. It's not the stage that we kind of fight between each other, because it's about empowering those user freedoms. I think it's the really important big goal. And certainly within the different desktop distributions, we do work together and where it makes sense, we share resources and we share code. And that can be seen at us co-hosting the Linux App Summit coming up in November in Spain.
Great, great, cool. And we're almost out of time, as I said. It's time to put out the call for action. What kind of volunteers do you need to help you along with your project?
So anyone that wants to get involved at all. So it's not just coding. It can be design. It can be engagement. So people who want to help look after social media, it's translations, documentation, anything. We have a really good newcomers system as well. So where people get mentorship, there's really good guides about how to get involved as well. So I think that's gnome.org/get-involved. And there's a load of way people can kind of come in, interact with us and kind of get involved in the whole project.
Excellent. And the next question is a little bit difficult to answer for everybody, and I recognize this. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to make sure we covered today?
No, I think we mostly got it. I guess it's a huge thanks for having me on.
Because that's what you have to do for that is set arithmetic. You have to take the entire set of everything you wanted to cover and then subtract the set of what we covered. And it's like, set math in my head. No, don't make me do that. Okay, we have two final questions then. One is, what is your favorite text editor? I think you just said you use VI. Yes?
I do use VI, although I have been using GNOME Builder, which is the new IDE, which has some really nice features. So.
Cool. Well, if I was using Linux desktop, I'd probably give that a try at least, and then go back to Emacs or go back to VS Code or something like that.
Well, GTK and Builder also has Emacs key bindings as well, so you'll be right at home.
Okay. Well, that's why I can use VS Code, because there's Emacs key bindings for VS Code, so that's really cool. And the other question is, what's your favorite programming language?
It kind of depends on the situation. I mean, I think I first learned PHP, but... when I'm feeling a little bit masochistic, I kind of default to Perl.
Oh, you said the right word, but you said it with a stabbing motion. It's okay.
It's great.
Okay.
At least you said the P word. Before everything, and it's fine.
Okay, that's fine. As long as you said Perl, no matter what context, I guess I'll take it whatever way I can get it these days. Well, it's been great having you on. I learned a lot about GNOME today. I'm not going to say I'm going to switch to Linux desktop anytime soon, but at least now I can honestly tell people, well, I've heard of GNOME. Yes, I've heard of GNOME. I talked to the guy who was in charge of it. So, yes, that's good.
I'll do the best I can to make sure that he does switch at some point.
You're gonna pry my OS 10. No, it's not OS 10 anymore. Mac OS away from my dead fingers there. Anyway, so thanks for coming on and being on the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
All right. That was Neil McGovern, who is the executive director of the GNOME Foundation. What did you think there, Michael?
I think it was a great conversation. I'm really happy that he came on the show and I got to talk to him again. I've talked to him a few times, and it's always really interesting to get his perspective on things, especially considering the GNOME is such a powerhouse in the Linux desktop world. Getting all those big questions answered is really great.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to see that these desktops also have a serious history. Did you say something like 20 years? It's been around for a while.
The interesting thing is that GNOME has been around about the same amount of time as KDE, and XFCE, which is now based on many aspects of GNOME, was before GNOME, and then they kind of transitioned to it. So it's like the history of the different desktop environments is really interesting because of how many there are and how they interconnect and how long they have been doing. So they started in 1999, basically.
Wow. That's a long time ago now. Oh, I feel old now because that's way after I got out of high school. So way after I wrote my first program for hire. Anyway, long, long time ago. So, the chat room was just pointing out we didn't talk about the pilot's license. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, we had such a great show on GNOME. We didn't need to get to trivia stuff like the fact that he and I are both pilots. So that's life. All right.
Just another reason to get him on back again.
Yeah, well, we'll just come back on in a year or two, and then we can talk about that at that point. We can see what GNOME 5 is all about. No, not GNOME 5, GTK 5, I guess, whatever is going to be out by then. All right. Well, we have some great shows coming up, including a couple few new ones added to the schedule. I believe, why didn't I put new by that one? Because that's new as of next week. Next week, we actually filled it in last week. My old buddy, co-worker on a project for about 6 or 7 years, David Fetter, who has been doing a lot of work with Postgres. He did the Postgres newsletter for a while. I don't know if he still does that. And surprising little blockchain. I'm sorry, Eric Deckman. We didn't ask blockchain again either. Boy, I tell you, I'm just off my game here because it was GNOME. Anyway, we haven't had Postgres on for a while. I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago. And then my very first show I ever did as the head guy of Floss Weekly was also a Postgres show. So that's the only two times we had Postgres on. And so David said, we got some new stuff happening in Postgres. Do you want me to come on and talk about that? And I said, sure. But it'd be nice because I haven't talked to David in a while. So, he and I, like I said, worked together on a project for many years. And I still maintain his code. Ooh, I hope I don't bring that up next week. We always, the client and I, when I have to go in and edit his code, say, Fetter. David Wheeler is joining us after that. I think he gets the record. I think this will be his fifth time on the show. And so he has a variety of things he does. He came on about 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe less than that, maybe 3 years ago, talking about the best practices badge, which is something you can attach to your GitHub or whatever to say, I follow all the best practices according to these standards, and it points at the site for that. And so apparently they've had some updates to that, and he wants to come back on and talk about that. That's David Wheeler. Yes, Web 101. He's the mayor of Floss. Yes, indeed. Indeed. So David's coming back on for the fifth time, for the five-peat. Just after that is Camilo, which I don't know much about. It's the successor of OpenSER and SER. It's an open-source SIP server. Oh, remember SIP? It used to be the big thing, and now it's kind of, I don't know where it went, but it's still there. I'm sure it's still out there. It's able to handle thousands of calls, setups per second, and it can be used to build large platforms for VoIP and real-time communication. So that sounds like fun. That actually sounds like fun, like kind of like maybe a competitor to Asterisk and things like that. I don't know. Maybe it's even better for that. Also, just added to the schedule. I don't know much about this. I was just Googling before the show. Hacker Public Radio wants me to be on their show and wants to be on my show. It's think of it as like Floss Weekly, but more than just open source, just like everything hacker related. So it's I think it's a daily podcast, actually. I was looking at the schedule, right?
It's actually got a community of podcasts too. They actually have a lot of different people who can come on and do a show on their network and their radio station. And it's kind of like they have like a Mumble server that you can join and do a show with them. You just, just have to organize it with them and then they'll help you distribute it. Stuff.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So we're going to have them on in 4 weeks. And then, like I said, I'll be on one of their shows, they said. So that'll be nice. So we can get to a trade there. So that'll be fun. And yes, my voice does sound a little bit better. It's sort of calmed down the last week or two. But I still notice a bit of scratchiness. So I'm not going to go out and try out for any musical numbers this week. But it's definitely a lot better than it was before. So Michael, thank you for joining me for this show. Your knowledge of GNOME and Linux desktop in general was definitely something I was lacking this time around. So thank you once again for coming on the show. Don't be such a stranger this time. Get back on the show soon, because I send out the request every week and you never respond. It's like, come on, be on at least some of the shows.
Yeah, I do want to come back on more often. I recently I've been doing a lot of a lot of busy work. So I was every time it was like my time, like during the day on Wednesday for me is like it was like hard to get it in there. So I'm trying to do as much as I can. And I would be interested in coming for the Hacker Public Radio for sure.
Yeah, and Web 101 says Michael did a fantastic job, and I agree. This was definitely great. Thanks for coming on the show, and
thank you.
And please come back for Hacker Public Radio, because that's obviously your area, and you brought me the show, so that's going to be great. So thanks a lot, Michael.
Yep, thank you very much. I'm glad I enjoyed it very much, and I can't wait to be back.
All right, and we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.